Today's episode of the Inside EVs podcast is brought to you by E-Range EV Tyre. E-Range EV tyres are specifically engineered for electric vehicles. Using an advanced manufacturing process called liquid phase mixing, E-Range EV's EcoPoint 3 technology creates a tyre with lower rolling resistance and longer range, while offering low levels of wear and high grip. All this while staying affordable. Go to erangetyres.com. That's E-R-A-N-G-E-Tyres.com to find your EV's next set of tyres.
Hello and welcome to the Inside EVs podcast for April the 28th, 2023. This is episode number 160. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we'll be talking about the Chevrolet Bolt EV and EUV are being discontinued. The Hyundai IONIQ 5N gets a next-gen battery. And General Motors and Samsung SDI have announced a $3 billion battery factory. And of course, much, much more. I'm Dominic Ioni, Inside EV's editor and forum moderator. Joining us today is the rectitudinous Mr. Tom Malogny, senior editor at Inside EVs and host of the YouTube channel, State of Charge. We also have the magisterial Mr. Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast, which is available on all the best podcast platforms. And of course, Kyle joins us from the majestic, practically palatial halls of Etispec Studios, where he produces high voltage videos for a number of YouTube channels. So welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
So, Kyle, where are the majestic, practically palatial halls of Etispec Studios this morning?
I am in Truckee, California, up in the hills.
Oh, that's nice. Truckee, how do you spell that?
T-R-U-K-E-E? C-K-E-E?
Okay. Okay.
So double E.
Sorry. Sorry to put you on the spot like that.
No, it's okay. I should know that.
No, it's okay. I've heard of it, but I can't really picture the thing in my mind. Anyway, good morning, y'all. So let's get into this. Let's talk about what we've been driving this week. Actually, let's talk about what we were driving the week before for some of us. So Kyle, so last week, you had just completed a cannonball. So that's traveling across the country from the Red Ball Garage in New York City to the Portofino Hotel in Redondo Beach in an attempt to do that trip in the shortest time ever for an all-electric car. So we didn't talk about it on last week's show because you wanted to have your video up first. And now it's up in all its three-hour glory. And you can watch it in high definition, too, now. It took a few days for that to process, I feel like. But so let's start with the cars. So you drove the Lucid Air, but you also had a Polestar 1 running with you. So maybe let's talk about your cannonball run just to kick things off. And maybe tell us why the Polestar 1 and how you actually got it. Because that's kind of an interesting prelude to the whole thing.
Yeah. So, you know, running across the country in an electric car sucks. No way about it. Like it's this is not a fun thing to do. Cannonballing is not enjoyable, but it's been a little while since there was a record attempt. And I thought, okay, I'd previously broken the record in a Model 3 in a Porsche Taycan. And I thought, okay, now's the time to see what the Air can do. And, 516 miles of rated range. But as we all know, it's not about the range. It's all about the charging. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you get that initial hit with the Lucid where we left pretty much full. And I was like, well, the car charges at 351 kilowatts peak. Like if we can pull into chargers dead, this thing might have a chance. And it probably would. But let's talk about that run. You know, we thought, okay, we're going to have about 20 charging stops in the Air, maybe slightly less than the 25 or 26 we did with the Taycan. In actuality, I haven't counted it out yet. I have a spreadsheet of everything, but we probably stopped the same number of times as the Taycan, mostly because the Lucid Air doesn't hold its peak power for very long. It has a very short peak and then falls off a ledge. And my understanding is that the Dream Edition or the Grand Touring Performance cars actually charge slightly better than the longer range Grand Touring in terms of the curve. This is just the rumor. I got to test that at some point. But basically, we had the idea where, okay, we're going across the country, not terribly fast.
Oops.
Efficiency and charging and range, and the slower the car charges, the slower we have to drive. And so, but I thought, okay, would be kind of nice to have someone just run ahead and look to see if there's any, you know, things we should know about along our route, whether it's traffic or potholes or police or, you know, whatever it is. And I thought, well, if there's going to be someone ahead, charging stations are starting to get more filled up, especially as we get towards the West Coast. Wouldn't it be cool if they could just like pull into a 350 kilowatt charger and block and hog the spot so that when we roll into the parking lot, you know, 5-10 minutes after them, they could pull out and we'll take that spot. And I thought, well, we shouldn't really be icing chargers. That sends a really bad message.
Right.
We also want to test to make sure that the chargers work before we get there. Mm-hmm. And there's really only one car that could do this, which would be a plug-in hybrid that could CCS fast charge. Now, that's pretty common in Europe. And Martin and I agree, this is the dumbest thing ever. Plug-in hybrids should not CCS fast charge. Then maybe unless it's a range extended, that's fine. Like an i3 situation, I'm okay with that. But we thought, well, there's the Karma Rivero, which would break down leaving New York City. There's no way that would make it across the country. I've reviewed one and I was like, is this thing going to break in my 1 hour that I drove it? And then there's also the new Mercedes GLE 450E, which is not on sale yet. But that will do 60 kilowatt DC fast charging and that'll be available in America. But we have one coming on test soon. But I didn't, it was not, it's like next month. I don't remember when we're getting it, but not anytime soon. And we couldn't put, you know, 10,000 miles on that car driving it all around the country. So it left us with the Polestar 1, which is this, you know, hand-built Swedish supercar that is just the most complicated car ever, but absolutely stunning. And so I called Polestar and I said, you know, we're friends with those guys over there. And I'm like, dude, like my friend JP, I was like, JP, I need a Polestar 1. And he's like, what? We do not make this car anymore. Like, this is out of production. We don't have any. Like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, well, we're running across the country and it's like the one thing that can like do a plug-in hybrid with fast charging. And I'm like, we really need to find one. I'm like, I can look for them for sale, but like, if you have one, that would be great. He's like, well, there's one in our like heritage collection museum. I was like, that sounds great. We'll take that one. And he's like, what? So he calls me back a couple hours later and he's like, so I talked to Gregor, who's the CEO of Polestar USA, and it was his personal car. And Gregor was just like, yeah, if the guys want to take it and run it across the country, we'll pull it out of the museum and they can do it. And so just the craziest thing. This is the literally Polestar's heritage collection car.
Right.
And yeah, then they let us, you know, we're going to keep it for a while. They're like, well, we're really not doing anything with it. So just keep it out in Colorado and drive it and, you know, do some testing with it and make some videos, do whatever you'd like.
Looks so good.
And I mean, yeah, we literally have put almost like 8,000 miles on this car already. And they're thrilled. Polestar was like, this is the craziest thing ever. I mean, from their eyes, the Polestar 1 just had to drive slowly across the country. So it's not like that really did anything crazy.
It right.
just had to be charged, you know, 20 times in preparation to make sure the chargers worked before we got there. And
Kyle, you need to buy that.
So I just offered a number yesterday to Polestar.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I don't know if they're even able to sell it.
Because there's a few around the country that you could buy, right?
Right, but this one has the story.
true.
And it's also got all the miles, which means it'd be a lot cheaper than the ones for sale. Because every one for sale has like 1,000 miles, 3,000 miles. This has got like, it's going to have like 20,000 miles by the time we're done with it.
Right. So, but I mean, wouldn't they need one for the Heritage Museum though, right?
Yeah, they
it's
can
like
go buy
the
a better
first,
one.
This is their first model, like the first Polestar ever.
Right? Yeah, there's 20 for sale in the country right now. They could easily swap it out. I don't know if they're, you know, they didn't say no when I said I wanted to buy it. But okay. Anyway, I made an offer. It was
okay.
I would say fairly low. Something I think that would be reasonable, but you know, not like lowballing, but I guess there's a big process we have to go through and it's sure. probably less than a 50-50 shot that we get the car, but what a cool piece of history. What a cool story that we got it. And yeah, I was like, if you're going to sell it to me, can I just keep it and put more miles on it for the next year and then get even cheaper? So the girls drove this across the country, Alyssa and Michaela, and they actually, not that this counts and we're never really going to publicize it, but they actually set right. a plug-in hybrid cannonball record with it.
Basically, yeah.
So that's kind of cool, but like also that's not really a thing and we would never make that a thing. because it's the same as a gas car with a battery.
Yeah, but
yeah,
no. It's something.
It was kind of fun. At least someone got a record out of this because the Lucid did not. And that's the sad part here is the car can do it. And the car, the Lucid Air, I have to say from the last time that I tested it to now is transformed. The software experience is no longer buggy. It's no longer crashing. It's no longer annoying. I've done about 5,000 miles so far in this Lucid. By the end of today, it'll be 6,000 because I'm driving back to Colorado. I have another 1,000 miles to go from here. This car rocks. And like, it's taken me a long time to really come around to really like the Lucid Air because like I haven't disliked it and I've really appreciated the engineering, but it's one of those cars I really had to spend a lot of time with. Now it's not perfect. There's a lot that like in next generation, I want to see fixed. And those things are still a little bit annoying, but it's pretty good. But let's talk about the run just briefly. We left from New York, ripped to LA. Tom and his friend Greg led us out of New York City. Huge thanks to those guys. They had the Mustang Mach-E with Blue Cruise. Tom left about 15 minutes ahead, paved the way out of New York. And then we followed along and passed him right by the Pennsylvania border. And so thanks again, Tom, for that. That was just epic, as always. And Tom did the same thing for our Taycan run, leading us out of the city with our friend Pete. And just a really fun sort of tradition now. And say we'll ever do it again. I don't know. But really, really
I'll fun. Be there if you do it again.
Thank you. And you know what? That process worked great. The girls left an hour ahead of us. You left 15 minutes ahead of us. We caught up to them eventually. And it was just really, really perfect. So those are the two cannonballing cars if you're watching on YouTube. And the Lucid, the run, you know, there's a 3 hour long YouTube video, which I don't expect anyone to watch, which actually has way more views than I thought. I thought like three people were going to spend that much time.
I watched the whole thing.
The retention rate on it is the craziest part. It's like 60 something percent retention on a 3 hour long video.
Nice. I mean, it's a compelling story. Once you start watching, you want to keep on watching, even if you know what I knew what the result was going to be at the end. But it was still a great watch because when you were watching it, you're in the moment, and you guys don't know what's going to happen, and so you just long for the ride, and it's just a wonderful watch.
It's like watching a movie.
No, it's crazy. So I haven't even watched it through all the way myself. I edited it, and then I was just like, I never want to look at this thing again because
I hear you.
What a bear to put it together. It took like 12 hours to upload.
Oh my god! So you had cameras running the whole time, basically. So you had 40 some out or whatever hours of video to like to go through from different.
So we had time lapse cameras running, but we kind of filmed everything on iPhone. And we had about, I don't know, 6 hours of footage that I cut down to about 3 hours.
Right.
Yeah. Which we don't typically leave, stuff out, but I thought this was like, okay, this is probably pushing it. Thanks to everyone who watched that video. And it was, I think, pretty interesting. The car is not the problem here. The car rips. The car sits at speed very comfortably. It's fairly efficient considering how fast we were going. And, I think the only thing that could really be improved on the car that I would really like to see would be a little bit more communication to the driver as to the temperature in the battery pack. Because I think we started to hotspot the battery pack towards the end. We were definitely not getting as good charging, even when things were perfect, into the drive. And I think maybe it had some issues cooling every bit of the battery pack. And also, I wish that the car had a better charging curve. The Lucid Air has a big peak down low, but it's weak sauce when you start charging it deeper. And so
weak sauce.
We have a big battery, but when you compare it to like stressing the cells on cars with much smaller battery packs, like Taycan, for example, or EGMP cars, it's nowhere near that level of stress when you compare the charging speed to pack size. So the C rate is very, very conservative. And that's good for longevity, but give us a cannonball mode that like the battery's dead after 3,000 miles. Like, let us fry this thing. You know what I mean? Like, we just need it to last 2,900 miles. And then, you know,
that's well, you're an odd use case. I think like 99.9% of our customers aren't going to have any kind of issue like that. But I think
You say that, but like, I think that's the reason to buy this car. The reason to buy the longest range Lucid Air is to road trip it. And it is to go places with it. And yes, there's, you know, let's say 90% of the people aren't ever going to do something like this. Right. But it's sort of like 90% of people who buy a Range Rover never go off-road.
True.
But you buy it because it can go off-road. Right. You know what I mean? Because it feels like, you know, what if I need to drive to the top of the mountain one day? I got to have, you know, all that crazy tech. And I think the Lucid should be kind of the same thing. It should be engineered to be the best, the fastest road tripper. You know, the best charging curve, the fastest charging deeper into the pack. And whether or not someone actually uses it, there's a whole different story. But so I have to say the car was great. Those are the two improvements I would like. The infrastructure was absolute garbage, and we knew that, but like, it's just so bad. Right. Charging this thing sucks on public infrastructure.
So that was really, so that's where all the problems kind of arose. Like the car did its thing, no problem. The Polestar 1 led the way, had no issues. It had a cracked windshield, but that's not the car's fault. The Lucid did just fine, but then mostly you use the Electrify America network.
Tried to not use them whenever possible, but unfortunately, right. We're like held handcuffed to this network.
Right, because that's the only thing in a lot of places. That's all there is right now. You know, it's like we keep hearing announcements like, you know, EVgo, Pilot, where's your big
But the station's in. So we had a couple EVgo stops, all of which were perfect. We had massive, over 300 kilowatt charging, big charging speeds. Those all worked.
Right.
We had a Francis Energy charging stop, which is like the least reliable network you can imagine. That worked.
Okay.
We had some issues activating that station. Francis Energy, apparently, this is what the girls told us, and I think we couldn't get the station to work. You need to set up an account 24 hours before you get to the station, which makes no sense. So we had to call Brandon Flash, who I believe is in the comments right now. And we were like calling him because this was helpful. The girls were ahead of us trying to get this station to get activated. So they had a 10 or 15 minute head start. And they're like, we can't do it. They called Francis. They're like, oh, we can't activate it for you. There's nothing we can do. You need 24 hours for your account to become activated. And they like charged Alyssa like $60 worth of pre-charging through this whole process. And she didn't even get a charge. So
that's crazy. Yeah,
I got to make a video about that. But Brandon we called him. He had the app, thankfully, and preloaded before 24 hours. He activated the station for us as we were pulling in. Then they only had a 10-minute window where you could achieve max power. So they had a 10-minute boost function on the cable, and then it would derate, you know, over 60 kilowatt derate. And so then we had to unplug. We had to figure out what was going on, unplug, restart the station, call Brandon back again being like, dude, you need to activate the station again, plug it back in. Then we got another 10 minutes of full power. That's not a good EV experience, but that sums up kind of the whole run of what we had to go through. We had a few great charging stops, and those were on Electrify America with the ABB chargers, which just a few weeks ago I was having issues with. So it seems like it's a good thing I took a Taycan on a trip, because we were finding that with the ABB 360 kilowatt chargers that they have, they have two cabinets linked to one dispenser, and each cabinet's 175 kilowatts. The single cabinet, the first cabinet on, but it wouldn't bring online the second. So you'd plug into a 350 kilowatt charger, and instead of getting the 270 the Taycan wants, we were only getting the 170 because it wouldn't bring the second cabinet. We didn't have any of those issues with the Lucid. Every ABB stop, we got full power. However, at about a half of the ABB stops, we had random charging that would just shut off, and it was error current difference. And I think it was just the chargers not knowing how much power they're outputting, and they would fault themselves out.
Okay.
So the credit card readers on the Francis chargers, for those asking, just wouldn't work. They were failed. So there you go. So the ABB chargers, that's where we made up our time. That was all the southern part of the country. That was Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona for first. Actually, maybe not Arizona, but Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. We ripped. That's where we were like, we can actually do this thing.
Right.
And then we got back into the Signet Chargers, which is right. where we started. And those, the Lucid Air is in a voltage range where there's a software bug with the Signet branded chargers where they just don't play nicely together. And there's certain state of charge windows on the Lucid that repeatedly we could figure out by the end of the run, we could get good charging.
Right.
But then there were others where we couldn't. And I think it has to do with the configuration of the power modules that are, you know, supplying the power because it's such a high voltage car. Like, for example, Taycan, it happens around 70%. On the Lucid, it happens around, you know, 0% to 5%.
Okay. And so it does happen on other cars. This is not a Lucid issue. This is a 800 sure. volt system kind of issue.
Well, we've seen it on 400 volt cars as well. We've seen okay. Teslas exhibit this issue. It seems to be much more prevalent on 800 volt class of vehicles. And yeah, we even noticed a little bit of wobble on BTC on ABB as well. It's just like, you can definitely tell these chargers aren't tuned for these high voltage cars. But what's crazy to me, the most mind-blowing thing about all of this is Lucid's partner charging network. Again, the car is fine. I have no, the Lucid Air, you know, I'm kind of sold on that idea now. That car is solid.
Right.
And we really put it through its paces. That, you know, but originally I think we were thinking, well, the software was kind of crap and little rattles here and there. And just like, little, yeah, certainly there's little things we can nitpick about the car.
Right.
Very few cars could honestly handle the amount of abuse we throwed at this thing without any issue. So I'm very impressed with that.
I think the word has gotten out about it because their stock has gone up, you know, 13% in the last 5 days. So everyone's watching your video.
That's what it is.
I don't follow any automaker stock. So I have no
idea. I just looked at it just now. Just pulled up just kind of see because yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Okay, but where Lucid made their mistake, and they honestly had no choice, but where kind of everyone's making their mistake, in my opinion, is partnering with these public networks that are not doing proper testing with the vehicles. Anytime there's a big software release for a charger, and Signet Chargers a few months ago started to get a new software release. And what was happening earlier on, and we're not sure if this was to fix the problem, but they were blowing up power modules, cabinets. We had a couple of videos that we posted where you would literally see smoke coming out of them. You hear pop, pop, capacitors blowing. And so I think this software was to start to derate or protect some of the power cabinets that go on in the back.
Uh-huh.
But anytime you release a software, you need to do regression testing. You have to have every version of every charger in your lab. You need to have every partner vehicle that's signed up with your network that's officially powered by, you know, Lucid is sold with 3 years of free charging with Electrify America. That is one cohesive thing right there. And the fact that the cars weren't tested with this software ahead of time, or they were and they decided to deploy it either way, is crazy. This problem should have never made it to the public sector, especially that we noticed this problem months ago. Like, this is not something new. So we made a big deal. Sorry, go ahead, Dominic.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to, hoping you can explain for the audience. So you call it the Signet Surge. What exactly is happening? Like, so I believe like the voltage varies a lot on your output. But are you receiving like zero charge or just some charge, or is it what's going on exactly?
Right. So the voltage can't actually change because it has to be matched to pack voltage or charging voltage, just slightly
right.
higher. But
right.
but the current is going insanely crazy. And what's happening is we're seeing, you know, output. You plug in the vehicle, it might charge steady, and then it goes absolutely haywire. You'll see 170 kilowatts and it'll just boom down to 40 and then boom down to 20 and up to 70 and down to 30 and up to 200 and down to 10. And it's so crazy and it's so aggressive, these spikes, that a couple charging stops where we were having the Signet Surge, we can see the power being ramped up and down. We're like, this can't be good for the car. And then we started to feel the car jolt. Like right. it was literally energizing the motors. It was spiking the pack with so much energy that I think, I don't know what happens. I actually have to ask Lucid what was going on. I meant to ask them.
Right.
We still haven't talked to them at all about this. I don't even know if they know we did the run.
Oh, so, really? I thought you visited their headquarters.
Yeah,
your dad I didn't tell them I was going.
I just drove up, took a picture of the car, and drove away. I was like, hey, everybody. I was like late for something. I was like, oh, just got to get the photo.
Okay. But
it was literally when you were sitting in the car, it was like, felt like someone was just tapping into your rear bumper and the car was being held on the parking brake.
Wow.
And you get these jolts and it just can't be good for the car.
No, that doesn't sound good at all.
No, I've never seen anything like that before. And wow. So it's not just a Lucid problem. It's happening with cars that operate in the voltage range that the Lucid operates in, which is quite a few cars. And I believe almost all of them are partners with Electrify America, those automakers. So this has got to be a total disaster on the back end, I would think. Total failure of deploying software. There's no other way of putting it. This should have never made it to the public in this state. Whatever series of events happened where this has been allowed to be deployed and be deployed for more than a few hours. Like, if it's this big of an issue, go back. Like, I'd rather be blowing up your power modules than blowing up my battery pack. I'm not saying that the car was damaged in any way. I'm just saying it's possible.
But
it cost us the run because we were getting such inconsistent charging, such low power charging. We were hours slower than we would have been.
Right. So there's also two runs across, or two routes across the country. You took the lower route this time. Usually you do the higher route and then come, you know, you cut south down through Las Vegas sometimes, but this time you went the lower route. And I think there was like a, you know, you had to obey the speed limits pretty tightly in a lot of those areas because of the law was out in force, apparently.
So we chose the southern route because of that ABB burst. It was purely charger based. Mm-hmm. The northern route's the preferred route. And this is my second time doing a cannonball in the southern route. And after the first time, I was like, never doing that again. And then here we are doing it again. Now we're saying we're never doing that again. Right. Because as soon as you hit, I don't know, like basically West Texas, there are police every mile or 2 miles. It was the most insane. Now, I've driven this route many times and never seen police, but we literally could not go fast. You know, we had spotters ahead, multiple spotters, not just the Polestar, a network of them. We had all of our detection equipment in the car, and it was like the annual police convention was going on somewhere around there because I've never seen more police. And that affected us slightly towards the end of it. We were kind of just like, we don't care anymore. Let's just send it because we were just like, if we're going to get a chance at this, we got to rip. And so we kind of just ignored that, just sent it anyway. We're like, yep, well, you know, we'll make an interesting story if we end up in jail. But you know, nothing crazy like that. But
you also had
an interesting route. Not the northern route's better.
Okay. So charging was definitely what held you back from getting the record this time. You got pretty close. So you're just a little bit over your previous record in the Taycan, I guess. Right. And if you hadn't taken the northern route, you probably would have beat your other record, I think. Right.
Maybe. Nope, probably not, because there would have been more Signet chargers.
All right. 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 And I also want to mention, so you couldn't speed, but so when people do this cannonball thing in gas cars, I mean, the record is so short now, you have to go like crazy kind of death defying speeds for like super long periods of time. That's not what you're doing here. I mean, sometimes those speed might get up there above other people's comfort zones, of course, but
we're not going that fast,
right?
And we just can't, because we have to balance efficiency. The point of this, and I'd say it in the front of every video, it's not look at how fast we can drive, it's let's push the car and the chargers as hard as they can go. And right now they can't go hard enough where we can cruise at, you know, 150 miles an hour like the gas car guys are doing. They're pegged.
To me, that makes the electric cannonball run so much more interesting, because there's so many other factors involved. You know, with the gas cars, it's just how fast can you drive and not get arrested, you know, because refueling is so quick. They outfit the cars with bigger gas tanks and everything. So like, I mean, that's crazy, but it's super dangerous. I love the EV cannonballs, because there's so many things. Like, Kyle had to put so much effort into planning this and deciding which route to take based on what charging equipment is there and how fast do I go versus, you know, speed versus efficiency. Do I make the next charging stop if I go 85 miles an hour, or do I need to keep it at 80 so I roll in at 1% battery? Like, there's so much more going on here, and I think it really makes it so much more interesting and so much more, like, I appreciate it more, because it's like a science to shave off an hour. So it's cool stuff.
Right. So what else did you take away from this adventure?
Yeah, well, learned a lot about the Lucid, and I'm going to make a whole video with improvements I think they need to make and things that I think they have improved that I really appreciate. you know, actually we spent some time driving in the canyons after the cannonball, just hanging out on some of our favorite roads with friends like Zach, who's Black Model 3 on Twitter, and a few others, and really had a great time up in the canyons. And the Lucid rips. I mean, like, that thing is unbelievably fun on a back road. I mean, it's big, it's heavy, it's soft. We have the little skinny range tires on it. But this thing can boogie when you push it. Like, chassis set up perfectly. The brakes are strong. Overall, that
would you say it's better than your Plaid?
I actually need to do a comparison back to back, and I'm going to do a track comparison of that. And it's not the most fair comparison,
right?
Because I really should have the Grand Touring Performance to compare to the Plaid. It's just hard to
or the other one. What's the Hardcore? The Sapphire Lucid?
Yeah, but not on sale yet.
Ah, okay.
So it doesn't exist yet.
Right.
So the highest Lucid would be Grand Touring Performance against the highest Model S, which there's like a $70,000 price delta there.
Ooh.
Which is crazy, because Grand Touring Performance is 180 and Plaid's 105, 110, something like that.
Damn.
Plaid is like the deal of the century right now.
Right.
It's crazy. I mean, that you should almost have to pay more to get that much acceleration, because you need to be careful in that car.
Right. I saw somebody tweet or something this week, questioning whether or not the Plaid should be sold. That was an article, actually, because it's just so quick. People are saying it's kind of dangerous if you don't, just don't put your foot down. That's all.
Yeah. It just requires a little bit of respect and think ahead. That's all. Anyone can handle it.
I wouldn't say anyone can handle it. I would not give it to like my 18-year-old son, which happens. People buy these, have a lot of money, and all of a sudden the son, grabs the key card or whatever and hops in it. You should not be driving a Plaid like unless you've proven that you can handle it. For me, when I was 17, 18 years old, I would have probably killed myself in it. I lost it in my CRX on a few bends a few times, and if it had that kind of horsepower, it would have been a worse story. So I mean, the Plaid is just insane, and I'm not for saying, oh, we shouldn't sell it because it's too fast. But anybody that buys one, better not give this to let somebody drive it unless they know that they're able to handle this kind of power, because it's that powerful, it's that dangerous if you don't know how to drive it. Because you get yourself in so much trouble so quickly. You can launch this thing on a side street, and in 3 or 4 seconds, you're going 80, 90 miles an hour. Now it can't stop fast enough for that bend in the road or whatever. So it's insane. I mean, it's a blast to drive, but God damn it, that car is fast.
Yeah, I love it too, because it ruins you, because everything feels slow after driving the Plaid.
Yeah.
I get in the Rivian, I'm like, can I even get into merge into traffic safely in this thing? So it just totally warps your perception of speed driving a Plaid. But it's an interesting car to actually learn. If you have an opportunity to take one to a closed course and push it to and beyond its limits in track mode and really learn how to handle something so big and so heavy, and then that's the place to do something like that. So I think enough on the Lucid Cannonball really sum it up is the car can do it, the infrastructure can't. We'll wait till that gets better and improved. It's crazy that these issues we're still dealing with years later. It's so funny. A video came up that I skimmed through that I posted 4 years ago, where I took a Kona EV on a road trip from New York to Florida. And that's like, I could have posted that video today and it would have been no different. That's the sad part.
Right.
It's just like, it was EFISEC chargers. Are the EFISEC chargers going to work? Oh my gosh, the chargers are offline. I got to plug into a wall outlet. Like, we're dealing with the same things today. Mm-hmm. And I really have to genuinely caution anyone who plans to do a lot of driving. Don't buy a CCS car. I mean, truly, do not. There's just no way around it right now.
I mean, you can see if people watch, the video, they can see the struggles, because it's not even just like the Signet Surge. It's like availability of chargers that are functional. It's like a reliability thing. And it's just... Yeah. If one station, stuff happens. So one station could go down, a site could go down, but then there's no backups. There's nothing else around for like 200 miles in either direction.
If anyone thinks we're lying or over exaggerating, just watch the video. Watch the Cannonball video. It's just right there. And you can put your own spin on it. You can say, this is amazing. We may not make it somewhere. Let's buy one of these. And so that sounds great. If you're in, if you, that's your mindset, buy a CCS car. But wow, it doesn't matter how good the cars are. The infrastructure is worse than I've ever seen it in a long time.
I mean, right, it has to get better.
For high voltage cars.
Right. So let's talk about a little infrastructure things, because so this week you also, so you, after driving all this, I don't know where you've been this week, Matt, but you've been up to San Francisco, you're in Arizona. So you went to Mesa, Arizona to visit, to try out a new fast charger prototype created by the team at NU, that's spelt NXU and it's pronounced NU. And it was formerly Atlas Motor Vehicles. So this was a sponsored video, I believe. Right. But I thought it was, you know, super interesting and a great look at what they're doing. I wasn't rehearsed or anything. It was, you know, like spontaneous, out of spec style. Not only what they're doing with chargers, but they also have a whole battery thing going on over there. So, but maybe just start by telling us about this 700 kilowatt charger.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting. It's basically a container charger, you know, container size. This is still a prototype. I think they're going to build their own enclosures and everything for their units. Right. But NU is going to own and operate, at least they claim, own and operate their own network. I mean, a lot of it is we'll believe it when we see it, but
right,
we're kind of believing a lot of it now because they're demonstrating the work that they're doing to actually charge cars. And they're taking a really interesting approach, which is big power, big speeds. And you guys know I love that stuff. Right. They have a 700 kilowatt cable on this thing that's immersion cooled in oil. You know, it's actually an Amphenol prototype cable, and thing is just incredible. I mean, you know, CCS cables are so hard to move around, especially when weather gets cold. And this feels like a version 2 supercharger cable. Version 2 cables were air cooled. They weren't liquid cooled. And this is immersion cooling, which is similar to version 4 supercharging cable technology.
And even the head of it is different. Tell us about that, because that's important. That's like for people to use, like, you know, the CCS fast chargers. They've made some improvements, I think, right?
So Mark, the CEO of the company, is like, it needs to be easy enough where my grandma can plug in a car. Right. And that's his test. If it's like, if his grandma can't do it one-handed, they're not building it, which I thought was really cool. So they're going deep into cable technology, into handle technology to make it easy, like the version 3 supercharger handle that's just a wet noodle that you just plug in. That's what they're going for. And they also want the most amount of power possible. So huge power conversion power on this thing, 700 kilowatts.
That's double the fastest thing we have here right now.
Sure, absolutely. And it's like not hard to add charging power. You just add more, you know, charging bricks, basically. They come in 40 kilowatt bricks or so. And so they're kind of doing that. But what NU is doing is they're tying together the whole thing. They're going to have battery storage, almost a megawatt hour in there.
Right.
They're going to have a relatively simple grid connection because, you know, that's the slowest thing to deploying fast charging is getting your high power grid connection. So they're going to basically find places where there's existing grid connections or bring in, you know, lower power ones to trickle charge that battery at, let's just say, 50 or 100 kilowatts all day. And then as cars roll up, they can just zap the power in. And it's not a new concept, but it's one that is just like bigger and badder than we've seen before.
Right.
Operate all their sites. So they actually want to see our viewers comment on that video and say, where's the most needed corridors where this has to be dropped? And they want to fill in the spot. So I was like, Quartzsite, Arizona, number one. Number two, Fort Collins, Colorado, my driveway.
So Quartzsite, you did a whole video on that particular site because there's a huge Tesla supercharger setup going in there, like 88 new chargers. There's already like 30 some chargers there now.
Yeah, I think there's 36 chargers and they're adding 88. And then you go across.
And how many CCS chargers are there?
There's 4 and 3 of them are broken or derated.
Right. So you have a whole video. You visit the station. I mean, it's like 200 miles each direction to the next charger station.
It's not quite that far, but it's pretty, you're out in the middle of the desert.
Right.
I mean, it's 100 plus. Yeah.
Right.
It's just like, yeah, certainly a lot of people are like, well, you're making up the infrastructure problem. I'm really not. It's really that bad. And I don't know why they would think that.
I mean, people have good experiences, you know, so they just, you know, where they are, the chargers work, you know. I know my home station,
more than half the chargers were good experiences. But that's not that's no way to measure a successful drive.
Right. But like, so last week I was at my local Tesla. So we got our little Tesla setups with like half a dozen chargers. And then we have like four Electrify Americas. And there was two vehicles there. One was charging and one was waiting because all the chargers were broken except for one. And it's like 100 miles any direction to get to the next one, basically. Unless you come into town and plug in downtown somehow, it's a whole situation. But anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, that is crazy. But yeah, the quartzsite thing in the videos there, it's just like 100 and something superchargers eventually. Right now it's 38 versus 4, and right. They're building another 88. It's just like, it's just crazy. So yeah, I'm not really don't consider me a Tesla car fanboy. I'm a Tesla charging fanboy. Their network is just the best. It's so great. So, yep, totally into that.
Kyle, right. Did they talk at all about doing like energy arbitrage or anything with these units? Because right. I'm trying to figure out what the business case is going to be for them to be profitable. Sinking that much money into such a giant battery, it's only going to be able to service a certain amount of vehicles. You know, if you hook up too many stations to it, then you're going to deplete that battery and you won't have enough power coming in. I don't know how they could make money on this. Did they talk about additional revenue at all, or like selling energy back to the grid during stressful times or something like that?
So yes, totally bi-directional, 100%. And they're going to do all that. But there's also a reason to put big batteries into chargers right now. And that's the energy storage tax credit, energy storage systems tax credit, where like an overwhelming majority of your energy storage system is actually covered by grants or by funding. So, you know, it's almost like the bigger the battery, the more funding you get. And it's a little bit of a scheme. I haven't actually talked to them about the business case in detail, but I think it's a little bit of a scheme to actually put the biggest, baddest chargers in at the lowest cost. And so this actually might make the most sense. They're not going to get hit with demand charges. They'll be able to sell back to the grid. They'll be able to, you know, if the whole town goes out, they're going to island the charger. It's going to have power. Right. And it'll be interesting. I mean, I think first step is let's see them deploy one in the public first.
Sure.
And then we'll see if they can sustainably build out a small network of these. This is their small one. Their 700 kilowatt mobile unit is the small charger. I charged at 1.2 megawatts on their big charger, and that they're like, well, it needs to be a lot bigger than this. And I'm like, these guys are my heroes because it's just huge power, for big vehicles and they're just like full send nation. So love to see it. And, but the big question is, will they make it? Will they make it into public? Time will tell, but no question the technology is working. And that's sort of step one, is to prove that they have something. And they've proved that to me, that they can charge cars all day long with this thing.
Right.
And now it's time to actually put it into the public and show that they're willing to take that next step to power cars.
They have a lot of pokers in the fire there. So they've got the charger, they've got the batteries, they're putting together the batteries themselves. You know, they're making their own modules and they have their own unique kind of format for that as well. And then they're still making this monster truck, utilitarian truck thing, which is,
yeah. Yeah, I think it's kind of, I think all the focus is on cells and charging right now.
Okay, right. That makes sense to me. And I don't know. It feels to me like it's a company that really needs like, some big backing. It needs like a, you know,
some, and I think some, they have quite a bit of investors. I mean, I met some of the investors,
but
there.
They need like a something, somebody with a, gives a money, a check with a, that starts with a B, you know, like
yeah,
a
billion, sure.
You know, well, because when you get into charts, like set up a network of like that, that's billions of dollars. You know,
I don't know how many chargers they're thinking about doing. It doesn't sound like it's going to be a huge, fast rollout that's going to impact our whole. No. Charging right. experience across the country. I think it's going to be a few here or there to start. And I'm sure it'll be a rocky rollout, but we'll see if they can survive. I'm all about fast, reliable charging. That's what they're all about. So our at least our ethos is aligned. Can they pull it off? Can they have the money to pull it off? Will they have a business case to pull it off? Well, time will tell.
Right. All right. So And you have some charging videos coming up. I don't know if you want to save them for next week or if you want to.
I'll just briefly touch on them very quick, just so everyone knows, just on the charging side.
Yeah.
I spent 2 days in two different laboratories this week. I was at FreeWire's engineering labs where they do some, you know, low volume production line. They have a high volume production line elsewhere, and went through their interoperability test lab and actually coded the Lucid to work with the chargers, and, you know, went through that process of what that looks like. And so that's all filmed. That'll be a long video coming on Out of Spec Reviews sometime soon.
That sounds
interesting. Yep. So that'll be cool. So basically we had, you know, communication boxes. We were looking at Slack tests. We were looking at the communication between the car and the charger mid charging session, just to kind of explain that to our viewers. And it was really a fascinating visit, I would say. And FreeWire is doing some really cool things. They're way bigger than I thought. Hundreds of people work there. And like it's like so legit. I was blown away.
right. Cause this is like a brand name. We've only begun to hear, right. But they've been doing lots of setting the groundwork for a while now.
Right. Absolutely. And yeah. So that was really cool to see those deployed. These are, of course, low power grid connection for high output speeds. A 160 kilowatt hour battery pack is the whole bottom bit of the unit. You know, I gave them my suggestions on what I think they need to do to improve the user experience. I think they generally agreed. We talked a lot about, you know, just the user experience of rolling up to a charger, how they should handle sharing between two cars, letting the users know the state of charge of the battery pack in the unit. And so lots of little things like that. But this was such a cool lab. We pulled all the chargers apart. I think our viewers are going to love the detail that we went into here. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely.
And then after this, I went to ChargePoint. Spent the whole day yesterday at ChargePoint, and that's one hell of an operation. Thousands of employees. Spent the day with Pat, their CEO, and a whole bunch of other engineers and everyone at the company. It was so much fun. They were so welcoming, so great, and they really showed us everything. I mean, we pulled these things apart. We spent time with their engineering team. So many things that I had no idea about that I'm sure our viewers have no idea about, showing how their just ethos is to design and build a product. A lot of their next generation products that are launching around now, much higher power output, which is the one thing I had complaints about ChargePoint, was they just had, you know, they were missing the cojones. They needed some big power. And now they do. Now they do. They have 80 amp dual output J1772 AC charging, which is awesome. They have, you know, up to a megawatt DC fast charging capable. They just need a connector that someone wants to put on there. Right. So they're there. They got the power. Everything is modular. Everything is, and I'll talk more about it next week, but this will be like a 2-hour long video. This will be a full in-depth tour of ChargePoint, and it was fascinating.
Oh, I have some Maxes in the comments here. Is this, I guess, something going on with a Kona Electric?
Not that I know of. Not sure what's going on there.
Okay.
Max always says things and then I never understand what he's saying. Like his whole Twitter feed, I don't get. So Max makes no sense ever to me, but we love that.
Utes today. All right. So also you have up a video that I thought was kind of fun video this week. We don't need to spend a whole lot of time on this, but a brand new Koda electric car that's been sitting at a dealership since 2012.
Oh, this must be what Max was talking about. The Koda. Yes. It's actually my Koda now.
Oh.
I love that so much.
So that's interesting. So I remember this car because it came out, you know, I was already writing about electric vehicles at the time, but yeah, it came out, what, 2008 or 2009? I think they presented it for the first time in 2009. Hmm. I think here, sure.
I drove one in 2011.
Okay, you drove one too?
A yellow one, like the bright, bright yellow one. They had a test drive at the New York Mets parking lot, City Field in New York City. And I drove my Mini E over there, and they had a bunch of journalists and people there. And the funny thing is, more people wanted to check out my Mini E that were there than the Koda. So I spun it around the parking lot a little bit, really slow. 0 to 60 in about 10 seconds, quarter mile, 17 seconds. I think it has 188 horsepower, 221 pound-feet of torque. And, you know, there's a reason why it never made it. You know, it was a good effort at the time because no one was making EVs back then. I mean, right. Tesla, when they started doing this, Tesla was working on the Roadster, and like that was like it, you know. I guess if the major OEMs didn't get in the EV game, people would have bought these because it would have been the only game in town. But once the other car companies started making, you know, EVs, there was no reason to buy this thing, in my opinion, at least.
Sure. I believe it's a Toyota Corolla chassis or something from like a generation previous.
No, it's a Chinese car.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
But I mean, but Kyle, they copied the Toyota Corolla. You know how they copy cars? They like reverse engineered it or something and copied it like a Toyota Corolla.
Yeah, it's a Galant, I think.
And it was the Coda was a spinoff from another startup electric car company. Does anybody know the name of that company? Miles Electric Vehicle, Miles EV.
They were making
neighborhood electric vehicles, and they spun off and started this Kona and partnered with the company in China that was building it and so forth. Right. But
so Miles was started by like an older gentleman, and then he kind of handed it off. And I think when Coda launched officially, it was being run by a guy named Kevin Czinger, who has his own like a high performance vehicle company right now, actually in California. Yeah.
So Kyle, you have it back at your place now, or did you just buy it? Did you trailer it back yet? Or
I'll tell the story really quick. It was brand new, unsold, window sticker still in the window.
Yep.
On the dealer lot, the original dealer lot. And some folks work for the dealer who were viewers, and they found it, and they're like, Kyle is going to lose his mind. So they DM'd me. I just happened to be there. And I was like, I'm 9 miles away. I'm going to pop over. It was perfect timing. And, we filmed the video going to check it out. We couldn't find the keys. The battery was dead, like the whole thing.
Someone stole the radio out of it. Somebody lives in the backseat, looks like for a while.
Yeah, someone lived in there. I don't know. You got to kind of.
The whole interior that thing, man.
Let's not review any footage of what's gone on in that car from the security cams, but nothing we want to know about. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I think what happened was after that night, I got back to my hotel, and Nick, my friend at DGDG, this is the dealer group who owns it. He texted me, he said, dude, I found the keys. And it was in like their original, like I have the guy on camera who had the keys. I filmed it the next day, but it was like the old guy who's been there for like 30 years. And it was at the back of his desk.
Willie, the janitor.
Yeah, right. He was the lot manager. He's such a nice guy. He's like, the Coda? He's like, yeah, I got the keys. Hadn't even thought about that in 10 years. And we put a 12-volt jump pack on the back. Turned the key, started right up, had 30% state of charge.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, Dominic, you need to get on Twitter because all this is on Twitter chronicled.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or you need to get on post.
No one uses that.
It does. You need to get that to out of spec detailing ASAP.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm thinking. This could make a great Colton video.
So, Colton is like, he's going to wear a hazmat suit. It's going to be great. Exactly. So basically, we started it, Nick started it, and we're like, it has 30% state of charge. How is that possible? And the only thing I can think is once the 12 volt is dead, there's nowhere for the energy to go.
Right.
And it's an LFP battery pack, so it should just last. It's great. And
it's probably a lot of voltage sag on those ones. So that's like the early LFP packs.
Yeah, great. But he literally started it. It's all on Twitter. Put it in drive, and then it started to move under its own power. And then I drove it. He let me drive it over to a charging station, and it charges.
Wow.
It's like fine.
That's amazing.
It is incredible. Truly incredible. So then the dude who runs the dealer group came by. He's like, we still had that thing back there. What the heck? We've been like, we don't know what was going on with it. They have to go through a little bit of like paperwork limbo, but they're just giving us the car for free. So it's not like I'm really buying it, but they're just like, just take it. You made some cool videos. They're like, we want to see this thing gone. And
just give them a little bit of a publicity as well. So people know that, you know, the DG guys are pretty cool.
And it turns out a lot of our viewers actually bought cars from the dealership. We received a lot of messages and notes. So, I mean, it just worked out well. It's not like they wanted to collect any money from it. It's something we'll never sell, probably. We'll just keep it around for people to enjoy and let, you know, viewers drive it when they come visit or something. I don't know. It's a cool piece to have.
The tires held air?
What was that, Dominic?
The tires held air?
The tires held air, yes.
Wow.
I mean, it needs new tires. I'm not going to run on those. But I think that's actually all it needs is a detail and tires.
Yeah, so some detail.
Yeah, even the brakes cleared up. Like, we did a couple hard brakes to clear all the rust.
Right.
And they're fine.
Sweet.
Crazy.
That's amazing. All right. So, Tom.
Sorry to take up an hour, but
no. That's
all right. I mean, all right, that's it for the Inside EVs podcast. We'll see you guys next week.
I enjoyed it. I had a great time. Tom, you told us about your Blue Cruise 1.2 drive last week, but I just want to let people know that you have a piece up now along with your video on Inside EVs. Anything you want to add about that real quick?
Not really. You know, I mean, you can watch the video. It's a huge improvement, in my opinion. The ping-ponging seems to be eliminated. Lane change assist works fantastically, in my opinion. So smooth, so intuitive, dialed in perfectly. It really works really well. The in-lane repositioning is such a cool feature also, where it just scoots you over a little bit. If there's a vehicle that's close to you, it keeps you in your lane, but kind of pushes you over. You don't even realize it's happening. But it's just one of those things that it just makes the driving experience that much better and, say, less stressful. When you're on a highway and there's a big tractor trailer next to you and it's kind of getting a little too tight, it just pushes you over a little bit and it just kind of gives you a couple more feet of space. I thought it worked great. Predictive speed assist might need a little work. I didn't have a lot of problems with it, but I know a lot of people in the comments that have driven Blue Cruise 1.2 have said that for them, you know, the vehicle seemed to slow down more frequently than it should on a big major curve. That's the vehicle will slow down a little bit if you're at highway speeds and you're on a big long winding curve, so it doesn't take the curve too fast. I noticed with my Lightning, if I have it set to, you know, 75, 80 miles an hour and I'm on a big, long, winding turn, it's almost as if the vehicle can't negotiate that turn and it starts going to the outside of the lane and then it'll say, you know, take control of the vehicle to grab the steering wheel. So this feature is meant to kind of not have that happen. If it'll slow you down a little bit. And on the roads I was on here in New Jersey, I didn't really have much of a problem. It only did it once or twice, but I seem that some of the other people that have tested it have said that still needs a little bit more work, that it maybe slows the vehicle down too frequently and too slow. It drops the speed too much. Okay. But I mean, Kyle did some driving with it. I don't know if you experienced that, Kyle, at all, but I didn't really. For me, it worked fine.
So noticed quite a few things, made some videos. The speed on the corners definitely went a bit too slow for me. I know, Tom, you also, you know, the speed changing thing where the speed limits with construction zones.
Yeah. Well, that's in the previous version too, but now it's tied to this. So you can't disable one without disabling the whole thing.
So I don't think, I think our car would allow us to disable it.
Really?
Yeah, I'm fairly certain you can disable the automatic speed limit thing. At least that's what I recall doing. And yes, you can set the delta, which we
I just set the delta up to 20 over.
Sure, and that eliminated the problem.
Yeah,
that way it stays out of your way. But I'm fairly certain you can shut that off separately. If I'm wrong, someone can correct me. But I thought I kept that off most of the time until we did the hogback test, and then we let it change speeds automatically.
So I thought it was a drop down within the predictive speed assist where, and then it just allowed you to toggle the speed. Maybe I did it wrong. You know, I'm not sure. You can disable it. Okay, so you can disable the speed limit without disabling predictive speed assist. Okay.
Well, I would just turn all that off if I owned the car, because like if it can't do a corner, I'll just steer it harder until it's like, you know, full oversteer. But I actually love Blue Cruise. Now I was Blue Cruise meh before. I was just it wasn't great.
Right.
It wasn't the best. And now it's pretty much the best.
Yeah. It really worked extraordinarily well, in my opinion. You know, just pretty much everything. The one thing I didn't like, and Kyle, you and I talked about this, was I was entering a construction zone at one point and my lane was changing. And it was going to just plow right into the divider. No, these systems have to offer you some kind of an audible or warning or something. It wasn't going to. And I held on to, like, I'm telling you, the last second, and then had to yank it to the right because I really wanted to see if it would give me any kind of warning. It gave me nothing. If you weren't paying attention for that split second, I was driving right into the divider. So, you know, that's an issue in my opinion. I know these aren't supposed to, this system isn't supposed to be able to avoid and make the turn, but it has to give you a beep or something in right. case for that. I know you're supposed to be aware all the time, and I'm a full advocate for that, but it's just human nature. If every now and then you might just get distracted for a second or two, and that's all it takes. The car has to understand, has to be able to identify that there's an obstruction and, right. And give some kind of crazy audible alert, in my opinion, just to kind of make sure you understand that you're about to hit something. And it didn't do that. But other than that, I thought it worked really well.
Totally agree. The systems need to be more communicative. You can tell Ford, there's a lot more to be done in this space. It's early days. No system works that smoothly. But Tom, you did quite a few miles on the Blue Cruise. I mean, overall, when you get this update on your Lightning, do you think it's going to be a night and day difference?
Yeah. You know, for me, the biggest night and day difference is going to be the ping ponging. The Lightning wanders so much in the lane, more so than a Mach-E does, because it's big and it gets pushed around by the wind a lot, especially 75, 80 miles an hour. You know, when I'm driving, and I use it all the time going up to Vermont and so forth, I went up to Canada, I did a 1200 mile road trip in my Lightning. I used it the whole time, but I was doing this the whole time in the lane. You know, I mean, it was almost just like, you know, playing a pong game, you know, bouncing back and forth. It stayed within the lane, but there's a lot of wandering, and it didn't do the Mach-E didn't do that at all. It was nearly perfect. So I hope that the Lightning also is improved. That's going to be the biggest thing for me. I can change lanes. I mean, it's a cool feature to have, but you know, it's really easy to do that. And what I like about Blue Cruise, when you do the lane change, and as soon as you get back to the center of the lane, it immediately initiates Blue Cruise again. When I had my Tesla, it didn't do that. I didn't have full self-driving. You know, when I would initiate a lane change, then I had it would shut off autopilot and I had to turn it back on. The Lightning, as you make the lane change, and it immediately starts back into hands-free Blue Cruise once you center in the lane. So to me, the lane change assist it's a parlor trick. I want it to stop ping-ponging, and the in-lane repositioning I think is going to be cool too. So I'm looking forward to it.
Is this going to be an over-the-air update for current owners, Lightning owners? Okay.
Mach-E's will get it first. Ford wouldn't give me a timeline on the Lightning, and I was pushing them hard on it, but it sounded like they were indicating it's not going to be anytime soon, like not within the next couple of months. Like it kind of seemed like Q3, summer? You know, or no, not even summer. It kind of seemed like, yeah, we're still getting it down pat for the Lightning. Maybe I'll be surprised, but, and like I said, they wouldn't give me a thing, but just the way I got that feeling that it's probably 5 months out or something like that.
So this is a whole thing with you almost crashing. This is why, and this is my little soapbox part of the show. I really don't like when automakers use the hands-free, like no hands thing with their ADAS systems, because no, stuff like this happens. They'll still crash into things. And if you're not, your hands aren't on the wheel, and something arises, you have to get them there. And hopefully, you know, you don't have to reorient the car in any way, but you know, anyway, that's just a little.
But the monitoring, Dom, the monitoring is very good. Like sure. It's amazing how that really can monitor your eyes. And I tried to trick it a million ways, put on sunglasses, you know, and then gradually close my eyes. Right. And as soon as they're closed, you got about 3 or 4 seconds and it starts alerting you to grab the wheel. So it really, you know, if you're not looking forward, it will disable Blue Cruise. So it's not like you can not be watching what's going on, you know? So, you know, I'm a big proponent of having driver monitoring and not just the torque sensor in the steering wheel. That's how you really get in trouble. You know, when you can fake it, you can't fake this thing. Unless the only thing I didn't do is take pictures of my eyes and put them on the sunglasses and see if I could have faked it out that way. I should have tried doing that.
Yes.
Right. So, all right. So you also did Tom, you also had you told us about your Ford Mustang Mach-E 70 mile an hour range test last week as well. But now the post in that video was up on Inside EVs. Anything you want to add real quick?
Yeah. So watch the video. It was good. It was interesting thing is I did 70 mile an hour higher range test on all wheel drive extended range Mach-E 2 years ago, right, back in 21. And at the time, the Mach-E was that version was EPA range rated at 270 miles, the combined EPA range rating.
Right.
The same vehicle now is EPA range rated at 290 miles, 20 more miles, right, because number one, Ford opened up 3 more kilowatt hour of usable capacity. It has a 98.8 kilowatt hour battery pack. It used to be 88 kilowatt hour was usable. Now 91 kilowatt hours usable. And Ford also, through OTA software updates, made the drivetrain a little bit more efficient, you know, increased efficiency a little bit. So that pushed it up to 290. So the first time I did it back in 21, I got 285 miles.
Right.
And the test this time, 285 miles, right on right. the nose the same. The only thing I will say is I did it this time. The conditions weren't as perfect as the last time I did it. It was perfect conditions. Sunny, no wind, 72, 73 degrees. When I did it this time, it was overcast, foggy. It drizzled a little bit. And it was when I started out the test, it was 60 degrees. So 10 degrees right. cooler, little mist in the air. So and it was able to repeat it. I have to believe if this vehicle had run the test in the conditions in 21, it probably would have went 290, 295, another 5 to 8 miles more. So, they have improved the range slightly. That's, to me, that's a fantastic result for this car. Almost 300 miles. It's one of the longest range EVs in its category, in its class. You know, it went further than I did with a Model Y when I did my Model Y range test. The all-wheel drive Model Y. I haven't done one in a while. We need to grab another one, maybe with the new battery pack, and do that again.
Yeah.
But and you could see there, look at how consistent it was each quarter of the test. 71, 72, 70, 72 miles. It's like you could just bank on 70 miles for each quarter of the battery if you're driving at 70 miles an hour.
Right. That's pretty decent. Right on. So also a couple of weeks ago, you took delivery of a Rivian R1S, and you have a deep dive delivery experience video going up on State of Charge channel on Sunday. Have you had a chance this past week to drive it at all? I was just wondering if you have any observations now about how different or I guess how similar it might be to the R1T.
All right. Well, yeah, that's for those watching on YouTube, Martin's pulled up. I made a little short clip of the delivery vehicle. I did a very comprehensive. This is an interesting part in the video here. You have to watch the video to see what's going on there. Something funny happened during the delivery vehicle, the delivery process. So, I went Kyle on this hour and a half video. Deep dive. We go over every feature of the R1S. Anthony was my delivery agent last time. If you guys remember, Sade did it, and she was a rock star. Anthony, killed it also. So this is what you get when you order a vehicle. You either pick it up at a delivery center, or Rivian comes and delivers it to you, and you get a delivery specialist that will show you all the features of the vehicle. You go over everything, and we went through everything. So if anybody has any questions about the R1S, watch this video. You pretty much should learn everything about the vehicle. And as far as driving it so far, Dom, not really. It might be, quite honestly, a little bit more, let's say, bumpy, like a little bit less planted, going over bumps and so forth. I really haven't driven it that much. I had the Mach-E, and when I had the Mach-E for all week, it's all I drove. I put 1,000 miles on the Mach-E in 7 days, I drove the hell out of it. But because I really wanted to test out Blue Cruise, I drove Kyle to Pennsylvania and back. And, so I think I only have like 180 miles maybe not even 150 on. So I still need to test some more things out. Kyle and I talked about the sound system. Rivian stopped installing the Meridian sound system, and they went with their own like in-house engineered audio system. There's been a lot of people complaining about it online. I'm not so sure those complaints are warranted. It seems like it's pretty damn good. It might not be as good as the Meridian, but it's a pretty good system. And I don't think I'm going to have any complaints about it. I still want to play around with it a little bit more, But you know, it doesn't feel like I got a new vehicle. I got it in the same color with the same interior, and when I'm driving it, unless you're just driving normally down the road, right. It's like a shame. I don't feel like I got a new car. I almost should have gotten it a different color combo, but I like that color combo. It's why I got it the first time. The forest green with Ocean Coast, I think, is just beautiful on both Rivian vehicles. So that video is going to drop probably tomorrow. It's a long, really comprehensive video. And like I said, there's one point of it that's pretty funny. And, it's worth checking out.
All right. So let's talk about some news this week. If you're looking to buy a new Chevy Bolt EV or EUV, I think I said Volt, Bolt with a B. Right. So get your order in because the automaker says it will discontinue that model this fall. So at $26,500, the Bolt EV is the most affordable electric vehicle in the U.S. today. And after years of it being priced significantly higher and then going through a total recall of all its battery packs, productions and sales have finally, really picked up and humming along. It's difficult to find on car lots. If you watch our podcast regularly, I went through struggles trying to find one at the price and color or whatever that I wanted. So Chevrolet will have a vehicle close to this price. The Equinox EV will supposedly start at around $30,000, and higher spec trims should go on sale this fall. But I don't know, Tom, is the Equinox EV really a replacement for the Bolt EV? Do you think Chevrolet should consider making an even more affordable Bolt again on the Ultium platform?
Absolutely. The Equinox, I know that they're advertising $30,000. I think that's going to be like the unicorn to try to get, I don't know if they could make money on that vehicle with the Ultium platform and the battery they're going to have. With that. So I think it's going to be very hard to get one for $30,000, like you can get a Bolt for $30,000. And it's such a shame. I know Bolt is old technology. It doesn't have Ultium. DC fast charges terribly, but for a lot of people that doesn't matter. So right. I'm not going to hang too much on that. I know plenty of people that would buy a Bolt that would never DC fast charge it and drive it 10, 15,000 miles a year. So I have a friend that does that. I actually got him to buy one, and he's never been to a DC fast charger, and he's driving it about 12 to 15,000 miles a year. He doesn't need to, because he charges it at home, and this isn't his, if he and the family want to drive 500-600 miles, they take their big SUV. But in any event, it's a shame because it's an affordable vehicle. It's going to get people into EVs that can't otherwise get into EVs. And I think GM has to replace it with something. And I think they will. I think maybe it's not possible for them to do it now. I believe they're losing money on this thing now. So, that's not a good business plan. But I think within a couple of years, you'll see them introduce another smaller EV that is priced even less than the Equinox. I think they have to. I think all the companies have to do that. I've been talking to Ford and trying to get, him out of them. When are they going to release the affordable EV? If you remember when I interviewed Darren Palmer, their CEO, Farley, I asked him, when are we going to have a $25,000 Ford? He kind of step that question,
right?
But the car companies have to come out with them, and they will. It's a shame this is going away. But it's not surprising. I expected them to, and partially because there was so much bad press with the Bolt, with the fires and everything. I think GM wants to put that name away, and I don't think that they were going to come out with a next generation Bolt with Ultium technology. I think they were going to start with when they do a new smaller affordable EV, it's going to have a new fresh name, and they're going to walk away from Bolts because Bolt equals fire to a lot of people.
Right. I think the Bolt has been kind of like a disaster in a lot of ways for GM financially, because with the recall, the expenses from then they had to idle the plant while they get all that going too. That's there's so many back expenses on the back end that we don't really see. That I think it's been a bit of a financial nightmare for them, but it's all worked out now. It's all everything's finally working and it's over.
Well, really quick. So Scott S. said, what's the Equinox starting price? It's pretty competitive with these, right? The truth of the matter, right, Scott, we don't know what the Equinox starting price is. GM announced that it was going to be $30,000 starting, like for a base model. But that was before we had all these crazy, you know, price increases with supply chain problems and everything. And everybody raised their prices on their EVs. They might put one out there for $29,900 that is like totally stripped. Like, right, or maybe we'll be surprised and they'll get, we'll get one for $27,999. That is equipped. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think you're going to have to spend at least $35,000 to get an Equinox EV with any kind of, you know, options, right, you know, so let's see. I hope I'm surprised, but, you know, I don't know if that's, I honestly just don't think it's possible for the manufacturers to make a $30,000 EV today that can go more than 250,000 miles, that has decent amount of features in it, that can DC fast charge quickly for $30,000. I don't think it's, the economics are there yet.
So I'm looking at, so what they're doing in China, so I, by this story I have in my notes, this other couple of stories that came out this week, BYD Seagull EV priced from $11,000. They got, you know, it's not like, it doesn't have the specs of the Bolt EV, but it's still like a 150 mile car, and it's
and what
smaller.
Kind of safety systems does it have in it?
Right,
is this car, subsidized by the government?
BYD, like, to, no.
I mean, you don't know that in China. You just don't know what's going on over there.
Are you starting conspiracy theories on the Inside EVs podcast?
But so this is like a, maybe a bit like a spark size, a bit bigger. It's a bit smaller, but $11,000. So I'm thinking, so GM's not going to build an $11,000 electric car, but something like slightly bigger than that and safe, like $20,000, $22,000. Is it? I think on the LTM2 platform, that's what I would like to see. I think with the LTM2 platform, it'll help them get their prices down even more. And the, yeah. Because the economy is a scale of sharing all those components and battery cells. I think whether they will do it, if they don't do it, you know, they're leaving the door open for companies like BYD to come in the US and take up market share. Or NIO is already planning like small budget EVs for their European expansion. So the Chinese companies are looking at that space. And if there's like an opening, man, it's like that whole nose under the, what the, tent of the nose of the camel under the tent, you know, once you get that nose in there, it's kind of over. So I just feel like OEMs or domestic OEMs really need to make sure they cover all their bases, all their market segments with electric vehicles.
Martin, do you get BYD or will you get BYD in the UK?
Yeah. So NIO, BYD and XPeng, I think next year they all come. And they're going to be really interesting. Atto 3, Atto 4, which is called the Dolphin. You know, that's 2/3 of the price of a Model 3. And you look at the inside of that, and that's lovely interior and a vehicle to load. It's charges really quickly, big battery pack, their blade battery. The specs are really good. The safety is really good. One of the Chinese cars got another 5-star Euro NCAP, and that gets more difficult all the time. And so, yeah, they're absolutely moving here. What they'll do with the US, I don't know, because as you guys reminded me a few weeks ago, you have those sort of import duties, which I'd totally forgotten about, and those extra taxes. So,
right. Makes it harder for Chinese companies to come here, but Polestar is doing it. But you get a good enough product, people will pay the extra money.
Yeah, but they're built from in the US from next year as well. So,
right,
that's not like a long term play for them. So,
true.
I think for Europe, then absolutely, yeah. The Germany for NIO, they're in Germany right now, and then they do the Nordics, and then expand to the UK next year. And honestly, I'm, today is fully charged. But I'm there on Sunday. The big EV event with, you know, the fully charged YouTube channel. So, but a load of them are there. And they're spending money and they're marketing and they're turning up at these live shows. And so I'm there on Sunday for anyone that's coming along. So I think BYD are bringing the Atto 3 to that. I've been a little bit off the radar this week, so I've not fully followed, fully charged, but I'm looking forward to going there to and actually I'm doing a talk on, if anyone's coming along, I'll see you at 2:00 on Sunday afternoon. Cause I'm on stage with Robert Llewellyn.
Oh, sweet.
Talking Chinese cars. Like the session I'm doing is should people pay attention to the Chinese invasion for want of a better word, and that's my session. So really looking forward to talking about that on stage. So yeah, it's happening, and it's just going to be a thing that happens as quick as people are comfortable buying those cars. I was having a look at the Aura Cat or the Great Wall Motor car last Thursday. I was in that, and that didn't blow me away because it's 30 something thousand pounds. And I'm like, well, I'll have an MG4 for 25 grand. Thanks. So, and there's MG dealers on every corner. So what's a Great Wall Motor?
What happened to the Funky Cat name?
Yeah. So
I think they have a bunch of cats.
In China, there's a few cats, and over here the Funky Cat is, I think, the name they've gone with over here, but I just wasn't massively impressed with it.
Great Wall has always been the kind of, like, you know, back in the day, they really like just copy stuff and it looks really bad, cheap. It's just copies of Western cars, you know. But now they've come some ways, but I'm not quite sure they're there with the BIDs and the Neos yet.
On the subject of the Bolt, I'm reminded of yesterday when my stepfather was really struggling with his iPhone 5. This sounds awful. I know the latest iPhone stuff, but they're business phones. So it's not like I'm like splashing the cash, but we just always have the latest iPhone thing. And then because business, we're allowed to have a new phone every year. It's a business expense. And so it sounds awful, but I know what the latest iPhone thing is. But I just Googled yesterday, what is the latest iPhone with the button? Because my stepfather in his 70s wants the button. He hates Face ID. He wants the button. And then I didn't even realize that there's a 2022 iPhone SE. And I'm like... Huh. Oh, yeah. Right. There was a 2020 iPhone SE and a 2022. Now, that would be off my radar because it wouldn't be a phone for me, but it was like $350 equivalent. And the latest, you know, what Apple do, like with the Watch SE, it's just fine tech. And for him, I'm like, this is brilliant. I'll buy him one of these. I didn't even know they made that with the thumb button thing. I kind of missed that. But that's what the Bolt could be, unless, I mean, Apple are great at making money on the tech that's not the latest thing. And if GM can't make money on the tech that's not the latest, just because EVs are a different beast to assembling phones, then they shouldn't make the Bolt. But if they could make the economics work, what's wrong with keeping the Bolt and the Volt on sale? So the Apple comparison perhaps isn't the best one, but I was reminded of that.
All right. So I don't. Yeah, we can't spend a whole lot. We have a few stories we can get through real quick. So this struck me as a pretty big deal, but I'm not sure if there's a lot to say about it. So the Hyundai Ioniq 5N is set to debut this year at the Goodwood Festival of Speed in July, but we've just learned that it will have about the same range as a regular Ioniq 5 because it has a next gen battery in it that will hold more than the 77.4 kilowatt hours that the car. I think it's 72.6 usable that those cars have now, but it won't take up any more space. So we don't have any info on the battery, really. Hyundai hasn't been talking up any special chemistries, I don't recall, but so it's quite likely that this will basically be like an incremental improvement over current chemistries or the current cells. So this is going to have even more power than the Kia EV6 GT. It will be around 600 horsepower to the Kia's 576. Torque is going to be up to 600 pound-feet as well. It's going to get a thicker steering wheel, rear wiper, but it's probably going to have like a heavier suspension bits too. So I think any weight savings from the battery are going to go into like the beefier motor and suspension and all that kind of stuff. So not a big weight savings, but a volume savings of some kind so they can get more energy in there. Thumbs up. And I don't know if anyone has any. Martin, have you heard any rumblings about this battery or whether or not it will find its way into other eGMP cars from the Hyundai Motor Group?
No, but what's impressive is they are improving. They haven't just got that platform and then they're just off and away with what was around 2-3 years ago. They made those improvements. What was it, last year or something? They used the silicon carbide inverters to improve the efficiencies on the rear. It's either the rear motor or something. They improved those, which added some efficiency, added some range. They're just making the vehicles better. I don't have any intel on specifically what's different about this chemistry or the supplier or anything like that. But I think what's impressive is they just keep making these cars better. A bit like with the new Kona and the new Niro, which I think you've just got, haven't you? You've got the new Kona with it, obviously a while, but yeah, they just keep making, that's the new Kona. Apologies if I missed that on the Bolt discussion while I was bringing up things on screen, but that's another great example. What a fantastic car. So sure. Not the greatest, latest, greatest technology, but
I think we have a review on Inside EVs. We did another recent driver review because it's been out for a while, but we just like the latest model year. I think we've got a review up this week on that. So if you go to Inside EVs and search for Kona, you can find that.
This thing looks so sick.
Oh, the Ioniq 5N? Yeah, look at those tires, man.
No, it is going to be the car. It's finally, we get a hot hatch that's electric, that's going to absolutely rip. And you know what? For everyone complaining about too expensive, this, that, or the other, just buy it used in a couple of years. It's going to be absolutely incredible. And torque vectoring, rear diff, more power. The last thing the EV6 GT needed was more power. And now we got it, which is great. And I am so excited for this car.
Right. This is like, you drove this and Tom has too. And you both came back with great reviews about how it handles, how it rides. It's just like an incredibly well-composed car. It has the fast charging rips, decent enough range. I think it's probably going to be 245 miles, I think, EPA in this N, I'm guessing.
So we have a couple like things about this battery pack. I guess Motor One says it it's not going to have more kilowatt hours than the regular Ioniq 5.
I think it's more kilowatt hours, but less in the same space.
Okay, because the EV6 GT had a beefed up battery pack from a wiring perspective and some other things over the standard long range model. I wonder if that's what this is getting, or this is getting a different battery pack than the EV6 GT. Because the EV6 GT had thicker wires, thicker bus bars, different BMS strategy to handle the power. Are we sure that it's just not that going into this car?
Let's see. Former BMW boss in charge of Hyundai Motor Group's R&D. Range penalty will not be that huge. When they say the electric crossover will have a bigger battery capacity without making the battery physically larger than the 77.4 kilowatt hour pack. So in my mind, that means like more kilowatt hours.
It also could be capacity to handle heat or to handle power. Maybe not just energy storage. I don't want to say we're 100% sure here, because I know the EV6 GT had a beefed up battery with the same charging specs and everything as the standard car.
I'm going to be at Hyundai in a couple of weeks, so I'm going to ask them about, see if I can get an insight into that.
Great.
All right. So this struck me as a pretty good deal, as a pretty big deal. As you may know, General Motors has talked about three new Ultium battery factories in the U.S. One is already built in Warren, Ohio, and it's been producing batteries since last September or so. And that should put out about 40 gigawatt hours annually. The second is a 50 gigawatt hour plant in Tennessee that's still under construction, expected to be finished by the end of the year. Then there's a third 50 gigawatt hour plant under construction in Lansing Delta Township in Michigan. So these three factories are part of a joint venture with LG Energy Solutions. And it was thought that there would be a fourth in Indiana, but apparently LG has decided not to get involved in that one. So General Motors believes it needs more than 140 gigawatt hours of capacity looking forward. So it's going ahead with a fourth factory with a new partner, Samsung SDI. So this one will have a little less capacity, I think, than the others, about 30 gigawatt hours. And it'll produce nickel-rich prismatic and cylindrical cells start producing around 2026. So it's a little ways out. But when it's done, GM should be producing enough cells a year that's to produce 1,600,100 kilowatt hour packs. So that's a lot. Tom, what are your thoughts about this deal? Any idea why LG might have walked away from the plant, or even what product it might put the cylindrical cells in?
So, no, I mean, there's no hint as to what product they're going to put it in. It would be pure speculation. And as far as, you know, why they partnered with someone else, you know, GM could have initiated this too. We don't know the whole, you know, what was going on behind the scenes. They just may have wanted to, you know, have more partners involved and not just, you know, tie their horse to, you know, one wagon. or tie their wagon to one horse. So, you know, it's we've talked about these battery plant deals a lot, you know, because we just keep hearing about new ones and just get used to hearing it, because this is, we're just going to hear more and more deals like this coming to fruition, especially now with, you know, the latest legislation passed to build batteries here in the U.S. You know, when I was talking to Ford, you know, we talked, you know, on record and off record about the need to secure more battery capacity than they even realize at this point that they're going to need. Yep. So all the manufacturers right now are looking to invest as much as they can so that they're not caught short in 6 or 7 years, because you can't just turn around and make a battery plant, you know, develop in a year if that electric vehicle adoption rate just takes off like that hockey stick graph that we all believe it's going to. We could get into a position now where 2027, 2028, Ford, GM, the other OEMs just don't have enough batteries to put in their vehicles. So just get used to hearing this. I think we're just going to see battery plant after battery plant being announced with multiple partners, and it makes sense to do that and not have all your eggs in one basket. You know, Ford's doing that, and Ford just keeps announcing more and more plants. You know, when I went down to Blue Oval City, just in that one region, the Tennessee and Kentucky, they have battery plants under construction now that'll be done in about a year and a half. That's going to produce, just in those three plants, 130 gigawatt hour. And then they have other plants being built in Michigan and in Europe. So, you know, this is all we're going to hear about now. And the manufacturers finally realize that this is the path forward, is to have battery capacity. If they don't have enough capacity, they're dead in the water.
Right. Yep. That's the who can build the most batteries wins, basically, at this point.
And I think everybody realized this 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, Dom. And I interviewed people from all these companies back then, but nobody was willing to say, oh, yeah, I can see when that's going to happen. Like that's far down the horizon. We'll partner, we'll make some batteries now. But now all of a sudden it's, oh my God, hurry up. We need to do this right now, because this is happening faster than we thought it would, which is kind of crazy, because so many people were telling them, you know, this is going to happen faster than you think it's going to happen. But, you know, within every company, there's always, you know, the bean counters versus the pragmatic people that realize that what's going to really happen. And we're at a point now where they all know it's happening. They all know it's happening faster than they think it is. So now hurry up. Let's get these plants built as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, Tesla knew it all along from the beginning.
Tesla, you know? Tesla, I mean, batteries. But Tesla and batteries. That's the thing no one's talking about. Well, people are talking about it, but that's the thing. Tesla and batteries. That's a bigger prize than being a car company. No offense, but the energy industry is a far bigger prize than the car, than stamping metal and making cars for people. I get it, the 20 million cars a year thing by 2030. I get that, Tesla fans. I understand that. But I'm convinced that's Tesla. Tesla know people are catching on. They don't want the conversation around batteries. This is why on the earnings call recently, Elon Musk comes on and is like, self-driving this year, and did the whole Elon Musk act. And I'm like, I'm done with the act, Elon. It's such a ridiculous act. This whole, oh, we'll do self-driving. Oh, I'm a genius. And I'm convinced now. That's a smokescreen. I finally had it on that call, and I'm like, I've worked it out. What they're doing is just the whole kind of Cybertruck thing and everything. They put all of the focus on that, and now they have to talk about, because of it's an investor thing, they have to talk about Lathrop, and they have to talk about the batteries, and they have to talk about it. But it's not even the 4680s. It's the supply deals they've got with the likes of CATL. Tom just nailed it. It's
the same processing plant.
It's batteries that Tesla have nailed and will continue to nail batteries. If the Cybertruck launches and it's garbage and everyone looks at it in the flesh and goes, that's terrible, which I would, and no one buys one, and I'm being facetious, everyone's going to buy a Cybertruck who wants to buy one. But if they never launch the Roadster, and if the Semi stinks, and if the Cybertruck's a failure, none of it matters. Tom just absolutely nailed it. Tesla and batteries, everything. I'm convinced everything they do now is just trying to keep your attention, the conversation away. They're like, oh, hey, we're gonna do self-driving cars and stuff. I'm like, oh man, it's all a smokescreen. That's my conspiracy. I like being a conspiracy theorist.
I love it. You got the wet noodle name. You're a conspiracy theorist over here.
Why are you a wet noodle? I missed all that.
I've never heard the phrase before, and I love it. I mean, in a minute, I'm going to go and see if wetnoodle.com has been registered.
Oh, you may not want to.
You probably don't want to be known as Wet Noodle Martin. You know,
it's a new phrase to me, and I'm loving it.
It's not extremely complimentary there, Martin. Flip it up.
Before we go, this is the best Inside EV show we've ever done.
Before we go, I wanted to mention that the Cooper Tavascan has made its official debut. So this is a European vehicle, but it's the second all-electric from Seat's performance brand Cupra, and it's basically the Cupra version of the VW ID4. And if I don't know if you can pull that, Martin, but if we can see it, where the ID4 has a very conservative design, the Tavascan is much more sporty. Its performance is definitely spicier as well. It's got the all-wheel drive version. It's got 335 horsepower, 500 pound-feet of torque. And to say it's like 0 to 60 in 5.6 seconds, which is, you know, not mind-blowing, but definitely better than the ID4.
But why won't Volkswagen Group build something truly fast?
I wonder.
Well, Porsche. That's what Porsche is for, and Audi.
Yeah, but like
IPO, they're separate.
I think Porsche is too separate. I think, like, why don't we have an ID3R that will smoke the Ioniq 5N? Where's that competition?
Yeah,
right.
That's what EV can bring, and I'm not seeing this competition heat up, sadly.
I mean, this seems to have like the components, like but they can put this in the ID3, some of these motors. But
this is not nearly enough for what you need. You need double the power of this thing.
Okay. Like 800 horsepower, say.
Yeah, we want an 800 horsepower ID3 that you can like do some stupid stuff in it. Like if you're wrapping it around a pole, like that's what we want, minimum. Like we want cars that will try and kill us, not daily drivers, Volkswagen.
Okay. So more power. Okay. Just real quickly to wrap up this, it's got the 77 kilowatt hour battery found in other VW MEB platform vehicles. But they say this one can fast charge 10 to 80% in under 30 minutes, when supplied with at least 135 kilowatts. I believe that's just a bit better than the current VW. Is that? No, is it the same?
The new packs do that too.
Okay, the new packs. I look back at an older charging test and the VW ID4 was a bit slower when I think Tom had done it earlier. But under 30 minutes, you know, sounds okay. But that peak
charging... They charge great, and they actually charge great up top too. So for all the ID4 owners that love to full charge your cars, you're in luck. The new batteries do it well.
They just don't have a high number for that peak power, but they have a great curve is what you're saying.
Yeah, nice curve.
Okay. And I think that's pretty much it that we need to talk about. Unless you want to talk about, you know, getting an extra second off your 0 to 60 with paying, was it $90 a month for your EQS or EQE sedan?
Yeah, it's on the EQS, it's $90 a month and you get a horsepower boost and you can make your EQS go quicker for an extra $1,000 a year, please. Yeah. I hate that with a passion.
So you can also just pay $1,950 and it's all done. All the subscriptions nonsense is done.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes more sense.
Yeah, it's good to have that option.
Sell it to me. Just sell me what the car can do. Don't shake me down for heated seats or whatever.
Right.
Anyway, I'm gonna ask my buddy ChatGPT. Some questions while you finish off. Hey, ChatGPT, do you think I'm?
You just capitalize? Oh. You? What are you writing?
Yeah, I'm a wet noodle.
Did you get called a wet noodle? Is that what happened?
Oh my goodness!
Do you think? Oh,
where's my band hammer?
I don't have a personal. ChatGPT says, if you'd like to discuss it, I'd be happy to help. To someone who is. Weak or lacks determination. Okay. This is, I don't know where this is going. We're not on delay.
Might need to blur the screen.
Okay. Oh, that's good. That's good to know. Thanks, ChatGPT. That's good to know.
All right. So that brings us to the end of our show. If you have any questions or comments, you can leave them on the Inside EVs Forum podcast thread or on our YouTube or Twitch comment sections. If you like the show, or if you didn't like the show, please give us a thumbs up anyway. Por favor. If you're watching this on YouTube, don't forget you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. Follow Tom Alogny at Tomalog. That's with two M's. Martin Lee is at EV News Daily. Kyle Connor is at It's Kyle Connor. I'm at Dominic on post.news. Click subscribe and tap that bell icon for notifications, and thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you all again next week. Ciao.